And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. So this week is a little different than the way we normally do it. I'm, if you couldn't tell, not in my home radio station. And so by virtue of that, we decided to go back into the archives a little bit and give you guys a couple of the deep dives that I did before my radio show was nationally syndicated. And so what you're going to hear are only things that my original radio audience at my very first radio station heard. And I think you guys are going to enjoy this because these are still relevant today. So sit back, relax, enjoy. And in a couple of weeks, I will be back with a brand new deep dive in my home radio station for you guys to enjoy. So with that, let's get going. So this week's deep dive segment, I'm basically calling it, for lack of a better term, and I try to come up with a couple of different names on this, but I'm basically calling it Kids and Killers. And the reason why is I'm not talking about, like, you know, killers killing kids or kids being killers or anything like that, but both of these in the last week or so have had some very fascinating articles and reports done on them and the lack of privacy that is causing problems for both children and one very specific killer that we're going to be talking about. And privacy is one of those things that I think we kind of take for granted, that, you know, we just trust it's there, or, oh, I have nothing to hide or anything like that. But privacy doesn't necessarily affect us. It can affect our children as well. It can also affect our family members. And so, you know, we're gonna start with the kids. I mean, have you ever noticed, like, you're talking about a product you want to buy, and then moments later, like, advertising just related to that product appears, like, on your, you know, your phone or your desktop or in your Facebook feed and all that kind of stuff? And the reason why that happens is that your online activity is actually being tracked by websites and apps. You know, in this case, for this research, it was Android apps. You know, it's all of this. And basically, what ends up happening is, you know, we are being tracked by virtue of, you know, what we have chosen to install into our lives, these applications, these websites, these apps, all this kind of stuff. And the problem that we have with this, aside from our own personal privacy, is that multiple apps were found in the Google Play Store that were basically discovered to be invading children's privacy without their parents' consent. Now, this study was conducted by researchers at the International Computer Science Institute at basically the University of California, Berkeley. And they also were in conjunction with the IMDEA, which is an organization or outfit out of Spain. Now, according to these researchers, they analyzed almost 6,000 different Android apps for children and concluded that overall, of these almost 6,000 apps, it was 5,855, that 57% of them could be working against the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which is basically a U.S. federal law that regards the collecting of personal data on kids under the age of 13. So 50%, like almost 60%, 57% of these apps, which is thousands of apps. And some of the key findings that they found here was 5% overall of these apps collected users' contact and location data, including email addresses and phone numbers. Additionally, 1,100 of these apps, about 19% or so, collected and shared sensitive data with third parties, even when their terms and services prohibited them from doing so, since these apps aim at behavioral advertising. Now, behavioral advertising is a technique that's popular among advertisers in which the user browser behavior is collected and used to present targeted ads. Just continuing on, like 39% of tested apps, that's almost 2,300 apps, were working against Google's terms of services by sharing persistent identifiers. They're also known as PIs or PIDs, a long-lasting reference to a digital resource. And so although these are not personal, these identifiers can be used to learn about the user's behavior or profile. And if you remember the whole Cambridge Analytica thing, they were basically based on likes, and they were doing other things, but based on likes, they were able to build a psychographic profile, not to mention the fact that, let's say, if, you know, if we're talking about politics and you consistently like one candidate versus another candidate's posts, news, whatever, well, then they start to get an understanding. Without you saying anything, simply by clicking like, they now understand you like one candidate over the other, and therefore maybe your advertising is based on that for donations, whatever that is. This is essentially the same thing that we're talking about here, but again, this involves our kids, our children. Now to move on, 40% of the tested apps were found collecting and sending user data over the internet without proper security measures, which indicates that malicious hackers can also get their hands on the data. That one bugs the heck out of me. Just coming as a cybersecurity, cyber warfare expert, if they are not just the default right now, the default in programming should be that when your data is moving from your computer, your device, your whatever to the cloud or to wherever it's moving, it should be encrypted in transit. So it's as it's moving along the internet from server to server and making its hops, it needs to be encrypted so that if a hacker is sitting between your device and that server and capturing that data, all they're capturing is encrypted data. That is just basic 101 right now. And so for 40% of these malicious apps, which is thousands of apps, mind you, that our kids use, there's just no excuse for that. That actually really bugs me. But I mean, there are more stats here. So 1,280 apps were found integrated with Facebook, in which 92% were misconfigured to protect the user that's under 13 years of age. It's absolutely crazy. And the researchers basically came out with a statement and said, quote, based on our data, it is not clear that industry self-regulation has resulted in higher privacy standards. Some of our data suggested the opposite. Thus, industry self-regulation appears to be ineffective. They went on further to say, parents are confronted with a nearly impossible task. Given the dominance of the Google app platform and the interest young children have in apps, it's not practical for a parent to have to spend time trying to decipher the complex connections that drive the ad-supported app industry. That's why we hope the FTC has finally awoken from its long digital privacy slumber. And so that is, I think, absolutely correct. I mean, I spend my life in cybersecurity researching, you know, and I do daily videos, as I'm sure some of you guys, you know, have seen, but I also wake up reading news like this every morning. Like I am ensconced in that. That is my job. But most people on this planet don't have my job, nor do they have the time. And I try to boil it down into, you know, a 2-minute video daily, or, you know, a 1-hour show every week or so, you know, on whatever, wherever you're listening. But this is a serious problem, and there are ways to, you know, make sure that apps are more legitimate than other apps. You know, especially if you're on the Android platform, you can have things like an antivirus, you know, that can scan the app to make sure it's not malicious right out of the gate. It can also be digitally signed by a legitimate publisher, but that doesn't necessarily mean they configured the app right, or they're not necessarily violating those terms of services. And that is privacy 101. And especially when we're talking about kids, you know, we are seeing an explosion in the dark web right now of full information being sold in identity theft forms for children. And that's basically coming off the heels of the entire Equifax breach when everybody got hit. Children have clean identities in terms of running, you know, fraudulent bank loans or identity theft scams and all of that. They don't have like an amazing or crappy credit history like some of us do. They have no credit history, and that makes them ripe for targeting and malfeasance. And so at this point, I know I've mentioned this before, the one bill that we all just have to pay now, especially for our kids that are under the age of 13 or 14, is credit monitoring. So if you have, you know, an identity protection management or credit monitoring and all of that for yourself, unfortunately, your kids need it too. And we also need to make sure that we are regulating these apps. But when it comes to privacy, the other issue that we have actually is with our families. And I know that a lot of you have probably done, you know, like Ancestry.com, 23andMe, other kinds of, you know, DNA testing. But what we don't necessarily take into, you know, privacy and consideration is those privacy things. You literally are signing your rights away in some way, shape, or form when you are signing up and sending your DNA into a third party. Now, it's possible that, you know, the FBI could possibly come in and get that if you're under suspicion. And it just doesn't necessarily affect you. I mean, what if insurance companies get a hold of this and see that you're some kind of carrier for some, let's say, cancer or whatever, and you never had cancer, but you have that cancer gene, and we're using that as a basic example. Well, now the insurance company is going to look at you, and with your data, they can apply that to your children. They can apply that to your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, your relatives, because you're sharing similar DNA, which means they might put you, let's say, in a higher risk pool than you need to be because, you know, grandma had cancer, and so now maybe you can. I mean, and these are the most basic examples of it, but it can get actually very specific. Now, I don't know if any of you guys have seen in the last week or so, but there was a serial killer that was active. I want to say it was in the 80s or so. Actually, it was between 1976 and 1986, now that I'm looking at it. And he was known as the Golden State Killer. And he was caught recently through DNA. And now what happened was, he didn't submit his DNA necessarily, but he had relatives that had. And they went, basically law enforcement went to a website called GED Match and used a fake name. Basically, GED Match about a week ago or so confirmed that their service was used illegally by law enforcement to see if they could take the DNA from one of the cases, because the killer had left DNA evidence at the scene, and they had submitted that DNA to GED Match to see if they could find, you know, either one, the killer, but two, possibly a relative that could point them in the right direction. And so they went to GED Match to do that. And so GED Match was unaware that this was happening, to their site. And so they released a statement that said, quote, "Although we were not approached by law enforcement or anyone else about this case regarding the DNA, it has always been GED Match's policy to inform the users that the database could be used for other uses." And this is exactly what happened. And so those members that have willfully submitted their DNA to GED Match could potentially have their DNA used against them or a family member. And that is a serious issue. I mean, and if we're looking at this and this becomes public record, or we don't have any real regulation on standards for privacy, and we're quite frankly entering new territory in the last few years, because DNA is now just becoming a major topic or a major thing that you can do. Like, oh, let's get my, you know, DNA profile, you know, and see what my ancestry is. You know, am I 100% Scottish or, you know, Norwegian or, you know, whatever it is. And I don't think I'm either Scottish or Norwegian, but those are the first two countries that came to my head, you know. But this, like I said, this can also affect you in many different ways in terms of, you know, you may have a better understanding or a deeper understanding of what your health concerns are, you know, as you get older and possibly for your kids. But again, that can be used against you. I mean, you could possibly be denied a job, based on DNA. You could have your insurance premiums, you know, revoked or jacked up in terms of cost if your insurance company gets a sample of your DNA, isn't able to run it and say, oh, you're a carrier for this, or, you know, you're higher risk for this, then, you know, that's a problem. And we know that we have genes that also affect behavior. So I know there was articles years ago about something called the God gene. And if you have this gene, it makes you more susceptible to believe, you know, in fate and higher powers and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not saying that, you know, that is the cause of religion or anything like that. But we know that gene could influence you more than somebody that doesn't have that gene in that specific realm. I think there's also a smoking gene and a whole bunch of others that, you know, that a gene for addiction, if you will, that, you know, if you have it, makes you more susceptible to gambling and smoking and drugs and all of these things. And if somebody were able to get a hold of that information, that is in any kind of authoritative capacity, then we are looking at something like a Minority Report kind of movie where they're predicting future crimes. Oh, well, you know, you have the gene that makes you more susceptible to, you know, want to rob banks because we discover that gene. Well, now maybe you've got more surveillance on you than you would. And you're just living your life and, you know, you have no desire to rob a bank, but you carry that gene. And this is a slippery slope that we are living in right now. We don't know what we're doing. And if you are submitting your DNA to one of these because you're interested, you know, genuinely, please understand, it's not just affecting you. You are literally affecting your entire genetically related family. All of it. Your mother, your father, your siblings, your cousins, your offspring, your great offspring, you know, whatever it is that is related to you, or whoever is related to you, now has the potential to be in that pool. And that's actually a rather scary thing, because millions of people have done this, which means there could be a full or partial genetic profile on all of us, especially if we share common DNA. And in DNA analysis, we can find out that, you know, okay, well, we are related to this person by blood. I mean, that's the whole reason why Ancestry, you know, .com exists, is that as it finds matches, it'll do this. I mean, there was a woman that, you know, I recently heard on the radio that was talking about, you know, she had gone to Ancestry and she was an orphan, and she had actually found brothers and sisters and like 20 cousins and like all this kind of stuff. And they started reaching out to her saying, oh my God, like, we're related. This is insane. And she's learned a lot about her life. And that's a wonderful, wonderful story. You know, but if you look at all of the people that Ancestry was able to connect her to, you know, now that's a privacy concern. That is, because now something like a government or an authority can start creating a genetic map of you and your relatives. And when we start to get everybody in there, when they're running DNA now on you know, let's say suspects or potential criminals and all of that, it can potentially pull family into this, or they can narrow the suspects down. And while that may be a good thing when we're trying to stop a serial killer, most of us overwhelmingly are not going to be serial killers or bank robbers or all of that. We're just, you know, good, decent folk that want to help each other and live life to the best we can, and in relative comfort and safety with our kids, and, you know, if we have kids and all of that. And that's the issue that we face today. It is a nonstop serious issue that we are facing. And until we start to see an understanding overall in the general society of this problem, they will continue to grow these databases. They will continue to get more information. Like, I literally do not know if any of my relatives, for example, have done this, but if any of my cousins have, then it's a serious issue for me, in the sense that now I am tagged in a genetic profile if my DNA is ever taken. So we will see where this goes. But it is basically, it's a new frontier of privacy. It's a new frontier of possible regulation. And while we may not necessarily always be fans of government over regulation and reach, when it comes to privacy, I mean, we literally have a constitution in the United States that guarantees that. But we have a whole bunch of different new technologies, new innovations, new pathways that, you know, hundreds of years ago, the founding fathers wouldn't have known about. And so we need to respond in that vein, in that light, to help ensure our privacy, especially when it comes to dealing with government and law enforcement and their ability to reach in and look at our data. So we're going to see where this goes, but it's a serious problem. And, you know, as always, technology leads the way. And in terms of cybersecurity, I mean, the consequences are, you know, pretty damning as well, especially if we're able to, you know, start looking at ways to hack the DNA. And I know that there are actual cybersecurity researchers out there doing that. Not me, but I know they're there. So this has been your Deep Dive Radio show for this week. And thank you for listening. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. This week's deep dive segment is called The Terrorist in Your Toaster, The Next Generation of IoT Hacking, or Internet of Things Hacking. And this is based off of an article I wrote earlier this year in February or so. And as you're about to witness, we have a large looming issue that we really need to start talking about it. So let's dive right in. When I was 5, my parents got me a robot. Connected to a wired controller, I could move it back and forth, raise its arms, flash lights, and plenty of other awesome things that would spark any child's imagination. I loved that robot, even though it sucked in a few different ways. It made me want to improve it, and I would dream of ways it could be better, like having it talk to other robots and machines. I was a tad too young for Terminator at this point, or making it do things for me. Thanks to the internet and the advancement of robotics, my boyhood dreams are coming true. We are at the dawn of this era, and the Internet of Things, IoT, is the foundation for this advancement, and it's exploding. Sadly, though, we must take the good with the bad. As we make our lives more convenient with IoT devices, we must also take notice of the increasing cybersecurity threats and issues accompanying this evolution. It starts at the development stage. A while back, I wrote an article about how many popular apps and some serious cybersecurity flaws they had, because while they were beautifully designed and engineered, security was essentially an afterthought. These developers failed to include security experts in the design and thus sacrificed this critical point, putting all of their users at risk. Unfortunately, this issue is also rather pervasive in the IoT world. In speaking with several IoT developers at conferences and also one-on-one with developers who are looking to collaborate with me, there is an overwhelming assumption that the end user of the device will secure it themselves. This may mean the developers assume that changing the password or putting it behind a firewall is something everyone is going to do. Nothing could be further from the truth. When it comes to security, a poor development strategy is a surefire way to end up on that list that shows the world just how easy it is to break into your device. And there's a website out there called Shodan that you can go to that actually catalogs open devices in people's homes and businesses that are exposed to the internet. You can literally log in to somebody's video camera, for example, on this site. It's absolutely crazy. If you want to check it out, it's S-H-O-D-A-N, Shodan. And it continues to the end user stage as well. The IoT development community should never make the assumption that the end user is tech savvy enough, especially when roughly 60% of all millennials actually have low tech skills. And this was an article that basically said millennials know how to use exactly what they want to use, ease of use, these apps, their phones, whatever. But when it comes to the actual nitty gritty or the concept of the structure behind the app or the device, they're completely lost. Most users just want their things to work and to be easy as possible. Unfortunately, developers build to this standard without much thought of how vulnerable this makes everyone. Consider the average user for a moment. This person knows how to use their mobile phone to make calls, text, IM, and run apps, just like we talked about with the millennials. They'll have a smart TV and can use Netflix and other streaming services. They run applications on their PC or Mac without issues. Odds are they're using the wireless router their internet service provider, like Comcast or AT&T, has provided them. They're happy as clams using the technology they love until something goes wrong. The average user cannot fully troubleshoot their own issues or have the knowledge to fully assess why their technology isn't doing what they want. Combine that with insecure IoT devices, they had no problem getting on their Wi-Fi using all the default options, and we've got a massive breeding ground for hacker malfeasance. Now consider that 24 billion of these devices will be online by 2020, and we can start to see why this is a looming problem. With so many insecure devices out there, we're literally sitting on a ticking time bomb, and we've already seen some of the small test explosions. As a result of these development shortcomings, we have seen some major attacks in 2016 that are essentially the beginning of this issue. As more relatively insecure devices come online, we will see larger and larger attacks unless something is done right now. In the fall of 2016, for example, a new malware infection called Mirai began infecting hundreds and thousands of IoT devices, usually CCTV systems like closed-circuit television and DVRs, by finding them on Shodan, the site I mentioned earlier. It's a search engine for open IoT devices. Mirai would find these devices and test them using a list of default passwords. Once it found it could be they could properly log in, which was a lot, Mirai would infect the firmware of the actual device, giving its creator complete control over the device. The creator slash hacker did what is known what is now known as the largest distributed denial of service attack, or DDoS or DDoS attack, in the history of the internet. Using over 150,000 infected devices, the hacker was able to direct the combined bandwidth of all these devices, internet connections worldwide, against various targets. Brian Krebs, who's a security researcher, was first hit and knocked out after a valiant effort by his host Akame to fend it off. Then the site OVH, which I believe was in France, was hit and knocked out with levels of attacking bandwidth reaching 1 terabit in size, which is an absolutely ridiculous amount of bandwidth. Dyn DNS was also hit and wreaked havoc with many popular sites and services like Starbucks, Netflix, CNN, and on and on and on. So if only 10% of all of these devices were infected by 2020, we would still have roughly 2.4 billion infected devices on the planet. Honestly, we need to act now. And all of this can be mostly avoided. Mirai, as it was programmed, would have never been an issue if the default passwords on the devices were changed. That's it. Hundreds of thousands of infections avoided because someone thought to change a password. This is only the start of a good cybersecurity policy for IoT, but there's plenty more that can be done on both developer and user sides. Let's explore some of these solutions that help protect many of the devices we're all going to be inevitably using. Point number one is password policy and control. This is a tip for developers and users alike. Developers, I know it's easier to just use admin or admin password on the zillion devices you're installing your OS/firmware on, but it's not acceptable anymore. Instead, randomize the password based on the serial number of the device or another method that will ensure that every unit has its own unique UI access password. And users, check your devices and never keep any of the default passwords in place. Also, never use a password that you would use for other things like banking. If the IoT device has poor hashing of passwords, that password may be captured by an experienced hacker. So definitely tier your passwords there. Point number two, use proper encryption. I can't stress this one enough for developers. Encrypt the firmware in the system so it can only be run when paired with the hardware it's connected to. This will help prevent spoofing and needless access to the coding of the device. If I cannot clone your firmware to see where the flaws are, then your device is way more secure, and the cost increase is mitigated by the marketing campaign you could have in advertising as to why your IoT devices are so safe. Point number three, internal firewalls go a long way. Developers, if your IoT device is configured to send traffic on specific ports, then why not lock down the rest to prevent attack? You could even go so far as to find an intuitive way to create a network whitelist so only specific computers or devices can interact with your IoT device. Token authentication or similar methods would stop any remote hackers from gaining access. And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.